Thanks for downloading this podcast from The Takeaway. I'm John Huckenberry, and if you're ready, we'll begin. It's The Takeaway. I'm John Huckenberry. Thanks so much for listening, and what a week, huh? We're learning about this country that chains people to walls for days and weeks at a time to get information, locks them away on islands for years, sometimes with no charges, tortures them to the point of death or near death, sadistic stories of painful physical abuse, forced penetration of body orifices, a country that seems to care little, if any, about the quality of information that's coming out of these unfortunate detainees. That country is not some tribal fiefdom from the Middle Ages run by a Genghis Khan. It is, we're led to believe, the United States in the 21st century. We begin this hour with the charges, the hand-wringing, the outrage, the shame, the alleged barbarity laid out in the Senate Intelligence Committee's official report on the CIA's use of torture, a summary of which was made public yesterday. Amidst all the adjectives, is there a window of reality? How can we even know? Part of the report details how the CIA engaged in a pattern of deceiving its own government, lying to the White House and Congress about the number of black site secret prisons, lying about the quality of the intelligence derived from torture, lying about the level of violence inflicted on detainees, and the big lie that enhanced interrogation techniques, you'll recall that euphemism for torture, led to the killing of Osama bin Laden. A lie that has already been made into a Hollywood movie, by the way, Zero Dark Thirty. How did we get here? Robert Baer is a former CIA operative based in the Middle East and author of the book The Perfect Kill, 21 Laws for Assassins. Bob Baer, welcome back to the show.
Thanks for having me.
Also with us is retired Brigadier General David Irvine, who spent 18 years with the 6th U.S. Army Intelligence School teaching prisoner of war interrogation techniques and military law. General, welcome to you.
Thank you.
Let me begin with you, General. What surprised you most here? What outraged you most? What do you think Americans should focus most closely on in this Senate report?
Well, I think the most shocking thing about that report is that it was describing acts and conduct by officers and agents of the United States of America. And secondly, that all of this was launched on the orders of the President and Vice President of the United States.
And even though they didn't know particularly the details, they basically created the culture that produced these abuses. Where did they get the actual torturers, based on your reading of the report? Any idea here, General?
This is one of the really curious aspects of the whole program. It was evidently promoted and sold to the CIA by two psychologists who had no experience as interrogators, who had never interrogated anyone, who had no experience with Middle Eastern culture or Muslim culture, who had no experience with law enforcement, and who evidently were completely uninformed about the history of interrogation in the United States as far as the FBI is concerned, as far as the Defense Department is concerned, who had no understanding of the prohibitions on torture that are a part of federal and international law. It is just astounding that these two men influenced an entire intelligence agency to abandon the practices that had been so successful for years and years and years.
And let's remind you who's speaking right there. That's retired Brigadier General David Irvine, 18 years with the 6th U.S. Army Intelligence School, teaching prisoner of war interrogation techniques and military law. Okay, so Bob Baer, it sounds like what the general is saying here and what the report outlines is that Bush and Cheney at some point basically put an ad in the paper saying wanted inexperienced psychologists to freak out bad people in the Middle East, willing to inflict pain, please apply.
General Irvine is 100% right on this. And I wouldn't put the blame doorstep of the White House, but I would the Central Intelligence Agency, who at that point had no experienced interrogators. It's something it had never done over the years, or at least not since Vietnam. And they go out and they outsource it to Mitchell and Jessen, two people who have no experience in anything. They'd seen a couple SEER manuals. That's what the SEALs use to train their own people. But what they didn't know, the SEER training wasn't for interrogation. It was simply to demonstrate to SEALs what it's like to be waterboarded and what they could face if they were captured. And it wasn't a way to extract information from enemy prisoners. Not only that, and this is sort of an aside, but I just find it completely offensive that they turned this into a business. They made $81 million out of this for doing something they had no idea what they were doing. On top of it, the CIA people assigned to interrogations were the lower 10%. They had all sorts of issues. They shouldn't have been in the field. In Afghanistan, when a young officer murdered a detainee, died of hypothermia, he was left out in the cold, he was awarded a money award. And not only that, this isn't a story, it hasn't been reported, but the chief of station in Kabul, a man I know, was given the Near East Division as a promotion, you know, after this man was murdered. So there was absolutely no accountability. And on top of it, it's very clear to me they were lying both to the administration and to the press. There's a journalist that wrote a book about this, a guy named Kessler, saying how effective this was. And even a reporter at the New York Times was fed this stuff that we were getting great information. So it was an effort to mislead the American public and not just Congress and the White House. I just think this is awful. And I just don't see how we can let this go. It's as bad as Watergate.
Remind us of those names you use, these psychologists who allegedly made $81 million.
This is Jessen and Mitchell, retired military, but they had not been in interrogations. And they simply took SEER manuals from the Navy without really looking at them and applied those techniques to hostile interrogations, then almost killed a couple of these people and did it repeatedly without letting people up the line know.
So how do both of you respond then to, bad stuff, but there have been no attacks? And, okay, maybe they were wrong about what led to killing Osama bin Laden, but, you know, I'd certainly rather have this situation than a bunch of, you know, bombed-out Mall of Americas around the United States if we'd let up and been a good guy like we usually are here. That's some of the comments that have come out even from former CIA officials who are responding to this report. General?
Well, I think those who are still claiming that the CIA interrogation program saved lives and produced all of these successes, at this point, after the revelations in the Senate committee report, really are under an obligation to show us the money. They have never done that. And there have been all of these claims that, well, if you only knew what we know, you would understand that this was very effective, that thousands of lives were saved. That's not the conclusion the Senate committee reached after 5 years. And at this point, for anyone to claim that there's still something out there that hasn't been revealed, that if we only could share with them or share with you, you'd understand all of this, I think that's just a false argument.
Bob Baer, what's your assessment of that?
Let me put it nicely. They're lying. There was no evidence, none that anybody's seen. I'm absolutely sure it would have leaked out that one of these interrogations saved lives and sort of like a 24 ticking bomb scenario. It just hasn't happened. And if a prisoner comes up with a little bit of information, they are showcasing that and saying, look, it works. But in fact, there has never been a case. And Congress, as you know, can't keep its mouth shut. And somebody would have said something by now. So, you know, I don't buy it at all. I've seen this in my career in the CIA, reclaiming we know something, and it turns out to be less than meets the eye.
General, what do you know, if anything, about individuals who may have stood up and said, I'm not going to do this. I don't care what happens to my career. I'm not going to go down this road with these psychologists and whoever else they found to do some of these things that Bob Baer describes.
I can't speak for anyone who is associated with the CIA. I'm sure there are officers and men and women who serve the agency who have that kind of indignation and who took those kinds of positions, but I'm not aware of them. I will say that there are others who stood up to the proponents of these techniques and who were incensed and who did lay their careers on the line. And one of those was Alberto Moro, who was the general counsel for the Department of the Navy. who took on Secretary Rumsfeld and who fought that program with everything that he had. And anyone who might be opposed to that program was frozen out of the discussions and was denied an opportunity to remind those who were promoting it that they were heading down a path that was not only illegal and immoral, but was also without any record of effectiveness that would warrant its adoption.
Finally, to both of you, what do you make of the suggestion by some human rights organizations that admitting a mistake is not enough, that what the United States needs to do to be accountable to the world is basically initiate some sort of Nuremberg-like process, and that this needs to be adjudicated in an international criminal court of some kind, and that detainees like the Jose Padillas of the world need to be represented as a human rights crime, war crime tribunal, and that that's really the only way to achieve accountability here. Bob?
Well, I don't see how we can go out in the world now and in any way condemn other countries for doing the same thing we're doing. How can we avoid this? How can we go to Iran and say you have to stop torturing people, you know, internal political prisoners? What's the difference? That's going to be a difficult road to go down, and I doubt we are, but it's a legitimate demand.
General Irvine, are we in the Radovan Karadzic Club all of a sudden?
I think we're getting awfully close.
Retired Brigadier General David Irvine spent 18 years with the 6th U.S. Army Intelligence School teaching prisoner of war interrogation techniques and military law. Robert Baer is a former CIA operative based in the Middle East, author of the book The Perfect Kill, 21 Laws for Assassins. Thanks to both of you.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
But Tony, writing to us on Facebook, says, contrary to all the outrage, the U.S. wins no global contests in barbarity. When I was in the service, Tony says, I saw firsthand what those terrorist animals did to our guys with their IEDs, suicide bombings, etc. Oh, what about all our fellow countrymen and women lost on 9/11? To hell with a lot of you and with all this other crap about how those terrorist animals were mistreated.
Hi, my name is Barbara. I'm calling from Carmel, New York. I really think that something should just be kept in our country. We were attacked. We're constantly under attack. Some measures have to be extreme. Look at all of the people that are being killed.
Hello, this is Jean. I'm calling from San Francisco. This whole thing just reminds me of the old Pogo quote. We have met the enemy, and he is us.
Okay, thanks, Jean, for calling 8778-MY-TAKE. So what do we do now?
My name is Michelle. I'm calling from St. Paul, Minnesota, and I am concerned that national security comes at the price of a lack of accountability. I just think that accountability is as important as security, and it's a part of security.
You can join the conversation. Find us at facebook.com/thetakeaway, or do what Michelle did. Call us at 8778-MY-TAKE.
Support for The Takeaway comes from TIAA CREF, a financial services company helping to create financial outcomes that matter. Learn more at TIAA.org.
So is the war against ISIS in the Middle East something that requires congressional authorization? As Congress flexes its muscle over the torture report, calls for better congressional oversight in the use of military force may create another kind of showdown between the White House and Capitol Hill. One former senator, now Secretary of State, is right in the middle of all that. Todd Zwillick, our Capitol Hill Showdown correspondent, Takeaway Washington correspondent, joins us. Todd, welcome.
Hi, John.
So let's hear John Kerry, you know, fighting acronym with acronym here, you know, ISIL, ISIS, whatever you want to call it. He is concerned that Congress will fight ISIS with a AUMF, A-U-M-F. That's an authorization for the use of military force. Listen to John Kerry.
We don't anticipate conducting operations in countries other than Iraq or Syria. But to the extent that ISIL poses a threat to American interests and personnel in other countries, we would not want an AUMF to constrain our ability to use appropriate force against ISIL in those locations if necessary. In our view, it would be a mistake to advertise to ISIL that there are safe havens for them outside of Iraq or Syria.
Secretary of State John Kerry speaking before the Senate Foreign Relations Committee, a committee he used to chair, right?
For many years.
For many years, exactly. You know, who's calling for this authorization for the use of military force in this curious week to talk about constraints on the U.S. government in matters of use of military force?
Yeah, well, John Kerry's statement yesterday, and we're going to hear more of it before the Foreign Relations Committee, was pretty remarkable in that he just called for an authorization that isn't limited to Syria and Iraq. That was the subtext of what he said there. Where did this come from? Look, Congress, the existing authorization for intervention in Syria aiding Syrian rebels is expiring. Mm. And members of Congress, especially at the tops of the Foreign Relations and Armed Services Committees, have been after the Obama White House for not having an integrated strategy against ISIS. They said they want a strategy and they want the president to ask them for authorization. Why are they talking about this now? Hey, this was buried underneath news of the torture report, spending bill, Ted Cruz, government shutdowns, and immigration. Nobody heard about this yesterday. Why now? The answer, John, is Rand Paul. Last week on a water bill, which was not being covered by anyone, Senator Rand Paul, who is planning to run for president, said, hey, if we don't have a debate on authorization to use of military force. In fact, I want a debate on a war declaration against ISIS from Congress. I'm going to scuttle this water bill. I want to vote on this water bill. I'm going to object to everything. And so they called a hearing in the Foreign Relations Committee to appease Rand Paul. That's how this got done.
So what other showdowns are brewing in this lame duck moment in the Congress? You mentioned government shutdown, and you mentioned Ted Cruz, always an entertaining figure to talk about.
It looks like they're probably going to steer around a shutdown scenario. Nobody knows what Ted Cruz is going to do on a great big $1.1 trillion spending bill that's coming before the Senate in the next couple of days, and we'll have to see what happens. But back to John Kerry for 1 second, John, because we just played some tape at the top of John Kerry yesterday saying that President Obama wants an authorization to fight ISIS that has no geographical strictures, not just Iraq and Syria. Listen to what he said about the use of ground troops. We all remember repeatedly, Barack Obama has said no ground combat forces to fight ISIS. Now listen to what John Kerry says.
While we certainly believe that this is the soundest possible policy, and while the president has been clear, he is open to clarifications on the use of U.S. combat troops to be outlined in an AUMF, it doesn't mean that we should preemptively bind the hands of the commander-in-chief or our commanders in the field in responding to scenarios and contingencies that are impossible to foresee.
I can't quite figure out where he is on this.
Let me help you out. What you just heard Secretary Kerry say is that the president has been clear there will be no ground combat forces, but don't restrict him in an authorization for force. Keep it open-ended. No. The president is serious, no combat forces, but don't put it in an AUMF. We'll never know what might happen in the future. You just heard the Secretary of State say, don't restrict the president geographically, don't restrict him in terms of ground troops.
Todd Zwillick, takeaway Washington correspondent, thanks so much.
You bet.
So back to the torture report in the Senate. Should anyone be held accountable for what was done in the name of U.S. security?
Yeah, this is Lee from Wesley Chapel, Florida. Americans must never forget that this al-Baghdadi guy who created ISIS was a prisoner in Iraq's Abu Ghraib prison until being released. When it comes to the subject of Guantanamo Bay, it would be suicidal not to understand that the aggregate injustice of keeping hundreds of innocent people in prison for life is a small price to pay for preventing the monumental injustices that would result from allowing just one person like this al-Baghdadi guy to re-enter the ranks of the world's radical Islamists.
Here's a comment from Salt Lake City. I can't believe it took 14 years for them to come to the most obvious of conclusions. What an incredible waste of resources, time, and loss of morality for unfounded guesswork. The CIA, this person writes from Salt Lake, needs to accept full responsibility and discipline and remove any and all individuals, including high-ranking officials, involved in this heinous, pointless exercise that has endangered our country far more than anything they could have invented on paper.
My name is Caroline. I'm calling from Alaska. My parents' generation lost hundreds of thousands of people. We all did, because into the future, we miss those folks, because we were fighting people who did exactly what our government has done in the last 15 years. How far do we have to go before we're worse than the Nazis?
Carolyn asks that question by calling 877-8-MY-TAKE. From Glenwood Landing, New York, I think we should follow the South African model of reconciliation. We should acknowledge but not punish the wrongs and move forward to make sure our country is the just and law-abiding place that we believe it to be.
Hey, this is Rod from St. Louis. It is and was a necessary evil, and it was necessary that we get that information.
Josh Newman from Allen, Texas. If we're torturing people, why are we necessarily going to trust that they are telling us accurate information? Furthermore, we have to consider, if these are bad people, if we are going to torture them and do the same things that they did to people, we are doing exactly what we're mad at them for doing. Why are we any better? If we cannot be the good guys in practice, then there is no being the good guys.
This is Bruce Bennett, Plano, Texas. The Democratic senators who produced and released this report should be held accountable for any deaths that occur as a result of issuing this report.
Join the conversation, 8778-MY-TAKE.
Support for The Takeaway comes from Lumosity, introducing a 10-minute fit test to challenge memory, attention, and problem-solving. With brain games to calculate baseline scores and build a personalized brain training program, performance can be compared to global averages. Learn more at Lumosity.com.
Among the problems laid out in the torture report is the practice of using subcontractors as interrogators, privatized paramilitary and intelligence officials, often with former military credentials, terminated from official work sometimes with the government, who found their way back into the war on terror with disastrous consequences. A similar pattern of privatization of official law enforcement takes place in the civilian world. Security guards, who you see every day, there are at least a million of them in the U.S., twice the number of police officers. How do they get these jobs? What training do they have to carry out what their uniform and guns suggest they're doing? According to an investigation by the Center for Investigative Reporting, the answer in many cases is we have no idea. Shoshana Walter, public safety reporter at the center, says the security guard industry is a parallel universe where the expected norms of policing simply don't apply.
The security industry actually is very different in some ways from the law enforcement profession. I mean, they have limited powers. They don't have the same ability to detain and arrest and search and seizure. But they're oftentimes taking the same types of roles as law enforcement officers. And they have a tiny fraction of the amount of training. In the state of California, a police officer is required to get a minimum of 600 hours of training. In the state of California, an armed guard gets 54 hours of training. So the difference there is huge.
What about the background checks and the arrest records and those sorts of things for security guards or armed guards? What is the oversight there?
We did a survey of the entire country, and each state is completely different. And what we found is that 27 states actually are not checking armed guard applicants through the prohibited possessor database. And that's a database of people who are prohibited by federal law from possessing guns. So you have guards out there who may have been committed for mental health issues, who may have restraining orders against them, may have been dishonorably discharged from the military, misdemeanor domestic violence convictions. They can become armed guards with guns in many states.
What about people who actually once were police officers and were fired, who use the security guard industry as a kind of a fallback plan B job?
Yeah. I mean, that is pretty common. The security guard profession is a great backup for law enforcement officers who were fired for misconduct issues, excessive force issues, civil rights abuses. And there's only one state that actually checks for that, the state of Oregon. But the state actually has never rejected an armed guard applicant who previously was a law enforcement officer.
And how did this get out of hand in Fulton County, Georgia?
There was a sheriff's deputy. He spent 2 years with the Fulton County Sheriff's Department. During those 2 years, he had a series of complaints and investigations into him, including over allegations that he had choked several inmates, beaten an inmate. He resigned in lieu of termination, and he became an armed guard in an apartment complex in Austell, which is a suburb of Atlanta. And while there, he picked right back up. He was hypervigilant. He carried a gun. Sometimes he wore a uniform. Sometimes he didn't. And within that year, there was an incident where he confronted a guy for what he thought was driving under the influence, picked a fight, the guy picked up a stick and this former sheriff's deputy shot him.
Is the fix here more regulations for screening applicants, or is it simply not permitting security guards, except in very special circumstances, to carry guns at all?
There are some states that do some things really well. Florida, for example, they don't require mental health examinations for armed guard applicants, but they do require that guards or their employers file reports whenever they use their guns. And the state does a really good job of investigating security guard shootings and immediately taking action if they see behavior that's dangerous or reckless. But in the majority of the country, no one's tracking security guard shootings. No one's monitoring them. No one's investigating them. There are only 12 states that require those reports to be filed. And even among those 12 states, there's massive underreporting. Regulators receive the reports and rarely do anything with them. So there's a huge lack of oversight into security guards and what they do with their guns.
Speaking to us from the Bay Area, Shoshana Walter is public safety reporter at the Center for Investigative Reporting. Her investigation, Hired Guns, was produced in association with CNN. Shoshana, thanks so much.
Thanks so much, John.
Finally, the CIA culture is a Rambo culture. It is not a sloppy statement about machismo and pointless aggression. Whatever you call it, and however you oversee it, the U.S. intelligence establishment seems to default to a culture that rewards the person who breaks the rules and does the no more Mr. Nice Guy routine, either with detainees, intelligence sources, or something as basic as following orders. In that environment, does a statement like this from Vice President Joseph Biden have any meaning?
The most important piece is we're big enough, strong enough, and consistent enough to say, we made a mistake.
We made a mistake. That's Biden's version of the importance of the Senate's torture report. We made a mistake and we'll never do it again. It's important to note that four of the people responsible for U.S. foreign policy were once part of the body that is supposed to oversee and constrain the intelligence establishment. Chuck Hagel at Defense, Joseph Biden speaking there as Vice President, John Kerry, who you heard earlier this hour as Secretary of State, and of course, President Barack Obama himself, all former senators, some of whom actually helped craft the flawed legal framework for our country's policies on detention. Jennifer Daskal is an attorney with Human Rights Watch and a professor at American University Washington College of Law. Jennifer, welcome.
Thank you.
So it's interesting that there are so many senators here in the senior policy realm of the Obama administration, and yet the laws that some of them may have helped craft or have had some input on seem not to have worked here.
I actually don't think the problem here is the law. So the law is pretty clear. Torture is prohibited. Thanks to the McCain Amendment that became law in 2006, cruel, inhuman, and degrading treatment is absolutely prohibited by a U.S. government personnel to any person in its physical custody, regardless of whether it's the military or the CIA or anybody else. And so the problem here was the interpretation of the law and how it was applied. So the law is not the culprit here. It's the way it was interpreted away by certain officials during this time period.
Now, is this rational and reasonable interpretation, or is this a, you know, what's his name, John Yoo, who's out at Berkeley, or Alberto Gonzalez, who really pushed things to the limit on some of these questions?
I mean, it's hard to conceive how this could be a rational interpretation of the law. Waterboarding, one of the techniques that was used in which an individual is basically the simulated drowning, and there's graphic testimony in the report about one of the detainees having basically being close to unconscious with bubbles coming out of his mouth. That's historically been interpreted as torture. We prosecuted people for torture for that in the early 20th century. So the idea that some of these techniques were deemed lawful, were deemed not torture, is inconceivable, and it's even more inconceivable that they wouldn't be deemed cruel, inhumane, and degrading treatment. And in fact, one of the more disturbing parts of the report, I thought, was the way in which certain officials in the Department of Justice reinterpreted the law even after there were changes made when cruel, inhumane, and degrading treatment was made unlawful, and there were changes made after a big Supreme Court ruling to the War Crimes Act. And reportedly, according to this report, there were memos that were being constructed that found ways around these legal prohibitions.
So the tidy public radio discussion about what to do now really should probably have nothing to do with more laws, you're saying, that it needs to be about prosecution of the laws that we have. Otherwise, the doctrine that you've just described will end up like the War Powers Act, ignored and on the books and other acts and legal doctrines which are there on the books, but nobody pays any attention to them.
Right. I mean, I certainly think that there's ways that the law can be tightened up. I don't think that that's a useless attempt. But I think the more important exercise here, I think the more important thing is the fact that this report is released. With the fact that this report is released, I think, is the best preventive measure we could have for these types of actions going on in the future.
But how do you say that? If former CIA officials are in the Wall Street Journal saying this is an imbalanced report, that it's partisan, and that it does not fairly characterize the U.S. intelligence establishment.
I mean, they have to say that. They're defending their reputation. They're potentially defending themselves from criminal prosecution. They're defending the reputation of people who worked for them. To their credit, they were operating in a time where they were incredible fear about what was going to happen to the American people. And they believed, I think, that they were trying to defend the United States. But that said, there's details in this report about just the lack of advanced planning. Nobody knew what to do with these detainees after they were taken into custody. There was some discussion in the report about how one of the first detainees they thought was going to be kept incommunicado for the rest of his life because they had no exit strategy. You go through the report and you see all the diplomatic costs where allies who were initially cooperating with the United States, when some of this started to become public, they withdrew their cooperation and they became increasingly more comfortable. The United States became isolated in its attempt to carry out this program, and it will be isolated going forward. Nobody's going to want to cooperate with the United States in this type of program. And operators are not going to want to put their professional lives on the line to engage in these types of actions in the future. And any rational leader would have to take into account all of the costs that are associated with the fact that something like this will eventually become public. It is not possible to hide it in secrecy. We know that from this. We know that from all the Snowden revelations that the Bush administration was doing a lot of things, carried on to some extent, some of them into the Obama administration, particularly with respect to surveillance, that officials thought could be kept secret, and it's not possible. And so those costs have to be taken into account. And even if Hayden and Rizzo and all those folks are going out there and trying to defend their reputation, trying to defend the CIA from, as Biden properly put it, were gross mistakes, it seems that those costs will and have to be taken into account in thinking about going forward.
If the Obama administration decides to prosecute no one here, which seems to be the consensus within the administration, it's a little bit of a Gerald Ford kind of our long national nightmare is over. Does that dismantle the laws on the books as you see them?
I don't think so. I don't think prosecution is the only form of accountability. There are lots of forms of accountability, and this is one of them. The public airing of this is one form of accountability. And to be fair, prosecutors have a hurdle here because there were legal opinions by Department of Justice officials that were justifying a lot of what was going on. Now, that said, there were other things that were done above and beyond what was officially sanctioned. But I don't think prosecution is the only form of accountability here.
What about down at Gitmo, where there are actual cases that are underway before military tribunals? Is this a field day for defense attorneys, the evidence that comes out in this torture report?
It certainly is going to strengthen their case, as it should. It should really yield some real concerns about how key evidence is used in the case. Now, the chief prosecutor of the military commissions is very clear. He's not introducing evidence that was obtained through torture or through cruel, inhumane, and degrading treatment. That's the law, and he's abiding by it. But that said, there's all kinds of concerns about the treatment of these detainees, about their mental health, and the potential for evidence to have been derived indirectly from these techniques as well.
Do you think this is partisan?
I don't. I think that this was a very thorough, very robust report looking through thousands and thousands and thousands of pages of contemporaneous reports by the CIA itself at the time that this was happening, and that there is a partisan reaction to this, but I don't think that this report is partisan.
Jennifer Daskal is an attorney with Human Rights Watch and a professor at American University Washington School of Law. Thanks so much.
Thank you.
React to the report. Is it all water under the bridge?
This is Mark from Fort Worth, Texas. I don't think we went far enough or ever go far enough in protecting American lives. Enemy lives do not matter to me.
This is Gar in Seattle. I think it's simply a case of do unto others and also kind of pay attention to the Geneva Convention. What prevents them from just saying, oh, well, you did it to us, we'll do it to you, you know?
What are you paying attention to in this debate? Visit us at thetakeaway.org or call us at 877-8-MY-TAKE. Thanks so much for listening. I'm John Hockenberry. This is The Takeaway.
Support for The Takeaway comes from the Henry Luce Foundation for increased understanding of East and Southeast Asia and the Rockefeller Foundation, whose transportation initiative is promoting equitable and sustainable developments in communities across the country.
PRI, Public Radio International.
I'm David Remnick, host of the New Yorker Radio Hour. There's nothing like finding a story you can really sink into that lets you tune out the noise and focus on what matters. In print or here on the podcast, The New Yorker brings you thoughtfulness and depth and even humor that you can't find anywhere else. So please join me every week for The New Yorker Radio Hour, wherever you listen to podcasts.